Good afternoon. Welcome to the last of the seminars of this term. I'm very happy to welcome Professor Robert Wargrove to today's seminar. Robert is a professor of social policy. Professor of what? Of social policy at the Department of Social Policy and Intervention. I think Robert is very well known for his work on welfare, poverty, child poverty, and these broad topics. He's written an enormous amount, 15, 20 books. He just told me he's got, for this project, 3 more books coming or in the pipeline. So I think a very, very interesting body of work, and always very much concerned with policy and policy implications, which is, I think, something that is important for us to see that we actually can learn something from. So, unfortunately, in a way, as you say, it's also very timely and relevant work, unfortunately, because it's on poverty, and if you read the newspapers today or yesterday, it's that we could be in for austerity for until 2018 or something. Robert will talk about a project that not only concerns the UK, because of course there might be an increasing problem here, but it's a big problem in many other places. And I think this is, and at least the little I've heard about this from Robert so far, very interesting, exciting work, a comparative work. So I'm happy to give the floor to Robert for the next hour.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your warm and kind welcome. I hope it's interesting, and I hope the books which we have contracts for get written. Just a small step on the way to the future. As you can see, I'm going to talk about the work of lots of people, not just my own work, and acknowledge that it's a project that's funded by ESRC and DFID. And it's rather different from the sort of research that any of you have read some of my stuff, you'll know that I've done before, which typically is dealing with numbers, typically is interested in issues of measurement, interested in issues of dynamics, interested in large data sets and how we can exploit them. As you'll find, this is altogether different, and therefore it's a journey that I've travelled on with holding the hands of all these other people. But its origins are very much in this department. They stem from a former master's student who went on to do a DPhil here, Lindsay Richardson, who was writing a paper for a poverty and social exclusion option in our department around the sorts of things Sen said and around the real tricky issue of relative poverty as to absolute poverty. How can we have a conversation about them since the concepts are very different? Is there any way of reconciling them? And she did some reading of Amartya Sen, the economist, Nobel laureate, and came up with this reading. And it's a reading of Sen. Those of you who know Sen know you can read Sen in any way you want to, and therefore is a really useful source of any piece of research. You have a bit of a challenge later when you try and justify the reading, but anyway, this was Lindsay's reading, that she found that he was arguing that yes, poverty is relevant, is relative to the societies in which it is found. But there is an absolute core to that poverty. And that absolute core is the shame that people experience. That shame, rising from people's lack of ability to fully participate in that society, is one way of thinking about a manifestation of poverty. So we're not necessarily beginning with income, we're thinking about income as part, if you like, of a multidimensional concept, one dimension of which is this notion of shame. And Martin Sen said it's shame or not shame. You can't have relative shame, it's an absolute concept, and that's at the heart of poverty. And that's what Lindsay drew from that. A bigger, more elaborate quote, distinguishing feature of poverty is the experience of shame. Freedom from shame, rather than material deprivation, is at the absolutist core of poverty. Interesting idea, I thought. I confess I hadn't read Sen in such detail. Is it true? Is it true that shame is that important? Does it lie at the absolutist core? Does that mean that wherever you have poverty, you also have shame? Is it possible, because shame might be in some sense absolute, that that could become a metric that would enable us perhaps to think about how we measure poverty in ways that embrace the global north and south? Is it really important in people's lives? And essentially, that was the challenge that we set ourselves, in a way to, I suppose, begin to test this notion of sin. There are others, of course, who have written around this topic. You can go back to Townsend, you find Townsend's talking about similar things, and indeed Galbraith you will find in this sort of area. But Sen says it neatly, and so we pick up on Sen and run with Sen for a little bit. Now why might shame be important? One might argue that it's pretty painful. It's not a nice experience. We've all been shamed in this room, not necessarily because we're poor, but for other reasons. You know how it feels. You want to retract, you want to step back. Just think about yourself in those situations. It's a nasty experience. Therefore, perhaps we should be interested in it, particularly if it does really become a significant component in people's lives. Another notion about shame is, perhaps unlike guilt, and we'll talk a bit about shame and guilt later, unlike shame, it's something which can be experienced, imposed upon you, for reasons over which you feel you have little control. You may not be personally responsible for the circumstances in which you find yourself exposed, open to a shaming experience. Guilt you can think about, you can change behaviour. You can confess on a Friday. It's gone. Shame is not so much about behaviour, so social psychologists would argue. It's about self. It's about the whole self. It's about character. Shame, you have the passport out. Guilt, you have the passport out by changing your future behaviour. Shame is much more difficult. Western social psychology rather suggests that character is affixed. I think it's quite an interesting empirical question, that, but nevertheless, there's a presumption that character is fixed. We can't change character. So, shame persists like a psychic scar that stubbornly refuses to heal. A classic a paper in a classic book on social emotions. Social psychologists also argue that shame is important because it impacts on people's physical and mental well-being. And this is the bit where Sen doesn't reach. Social psychology argues that because of its impact on physical and mental well-being, particularly the latter, that serves to reduce people's agency, serves to erode their ability to help themselves. If true, the policy implications of that are profound when you think about the extent to which policies that we put in place may themselves carry shame. There's a big literature, of course, on the stigma associated with claiming benefits. Stigma, the manifestation of that, a response to that stigma, is shame. So you have the beginnings of a story which will be really interesting to explore. So poverty leads to shame, and shame leads to low self-worth leads to a lack of agency. Maybe there's a feedback loop as a result of that. That because one's ability to, in a sense, act and behave in your own self-interest, that perpetuates poverty. We know that shame brings about a process of social exclusion, a two-way process. Both we exclude those who are shamed, and the people who are feeling ashamed, retreat. You know, if your physical presentation of shame is very much that. It's common across all primates too. So it's about this exclusion, being excluded and excluding oneself. Socially excluded, lack of self-worth, back to agency. Social exclusion, lack of social capital, ability to use our contacts in order to promote our interests. Again, perhaps a feedback loop. So you possibly have a reinforcing cycle. Now, one of the critiques of Sen, of course, is individualistic. The world is structural. We're in a department of sociology here, for goodness sake. What are the structural components that might be in this? Well, To an extent, that shame is a social emotion. It's internally felt, but externally imposed. We as a society arguably shame other people. We might do it for functional reasons. One analysis would be that it's a way of building society. So society could be culpable or involved in this process of shaming, and indeed all the evidence is that it is. The crucial bit, as far as I'm concerned, because as in the introduction you said, that I'm interested in the policy implications of this. To what extent is policy part of that social shaming process? And if you're reading anything to do with a debate about welfare and scroungers and about the undeserving and about the workless and about the underclass, you can begin to pick up signs and symbols that are consistent with this notion of a shaming process in relation to people who are on low incomes. Okay, so that's the sort of model that one comes up with. It's a model which we don't seek to test, we certainly seek to explore. I think as a result of our journey, we have evidence that's consistent with that thesis. We certainly don't yet have a demonstrable proof. But as the policy process is such, we don't need proof, we need a good story, and so we've already brought about a policy change, which I shall talk about later. There's a real issue, a moral issue, about bringing about policy change when you have a good story but not definitive proof, and that's one of the interesting issues about straddling this divide between the policy process and the scientific process. Okay, so the research that I'm going to talk about falls into four sections. We're interested, first of all, to know whether it's possible to talk about issues of shame and poverty in very disparate environments. Why would you want to talk about them in very disparate environments? Well, if you've got limited resources and you want to test a universal, you look for very different environments on the basis that if you find a story, some sort of relationship between poverty and shame in very extremely different places, maybe that gives you some degree of confidence that this is in some sense a universal relationship. If you find it doesn't, well, that begins to question the universality of Sen's assumption that at the absolute core of poverty is shame, and that is found everywhere. We needed to get some sort of handle, therefore, if we were going to work in different cultures, about whether the words or the concepts of shame and poverty could be talked about across those different cultural divides. And we went about that in a number of ways, but to cut the story short, we looked at literature, we looked at film, and we looked at oral traditions. Different according to the countries in which we were operating. So for the literature, we took syllabuses in secondary school, looked at what was on those lists, looked at who the authors were, added to a series of volumes, which we then did a content analysis to see whether indeed there was a discussion of something that we thought was shame, they thought was shame, and whether it was coincident in their discussion around poverty as well. Our conclusion was that there was enough in common, we felt, that facilitated the research to continue. We then talked to people who were experiencing poverty. Now, this is not, unlike my previous work, large-scale survey work, it's qualitative work. So we're talking in each of what will become clear is seven countries. We're talking to about 30, 35, 40 adults. Broadly speaking, split between men and women, within four of the countries, I think, conversations with children as well. And we're not going to say to them, tell me how you feel. You feel shame, don't you, because of your income? We get them to talk about their lives. And in the context of their lives, we see whether issues of poverty emerge, difficulty of making ends meet, and whether issues about shame, the embarrassment that comes perhaps as a consequence of that. But if shame is internally felt, the argument is also that it's externally imposed. Therefore, we needed to talk to people who weren't currently poor. And we did that again in a qualitative way. We did some sort of analysis of the World Value Survey, but broadly the core of our material is the result of a series of focus groups, which was done in six of our seven countries, talking to people who were not currently poor. And again, we didn't say, you know, talk about shame, talk about poverty. We said, we did actually in most cases talk about low income and hardship. And when the word poverty came up, we began to say, well, okay, what are the causes of poverty? And that's the way that we got into engaged in terms of our understanding of their understanding of what poverty was and who the poor were and why they were poor. And that was the conversation that we had in that last group. Remember, you need to stick another animation to get my circle. The circle is, I'm going to talk about sections 2 and 3 of this project because I've got a limited amount of time. 4 was the policy analysis. It was saying, okay, let's look at the anti-poverty programs in these countries and let's look at them through a lens which prioritises shame. There are lots of reasons why policy comes into existence. There's lots of reasons why policy is more or less effective. Here we were imposing a lens of shame to see what sort of stories we could tell. And that is the broad framework of our research. So it's essentially qualitative. It's a testing in a way or exploring a universal. It doesn't claim to come up with a definitive test of that model. That's what I'd love to do next, but I'm not quite sure how to do it. So we can have a discussion. You can tell me at the end of this session how to go about it. So these are the countries that we're operating in. I can come up with a logical reason for why we chose these countries. You can see they're very different in terms of their cultural background, their colonial background, their religious beliefs, etc. But I also happen to know people who were living in these countries, who I'd worked with before, and who could therefore become a team of people who had previously worked together. Okay, again, the purism of research and the practicalities of doing it. Because if you're working across very different cultures over a long period of time, you need to have a great element of trust. Parenthesis, there's a degree to which the trust of the team is breaking down at the moment, and one of the challenging management tasks is to actually put it together. Again, we might pick up on that, and it reflects the difficulties of working in authoritarian regimes and the implications of that for the freedom of researchers to tell the story that they believe to be true. And it is a real problem. So we talked to adults, men and women across these countries. We looked, talked to children in India and Pakistan and United Kingdom and Uganda. They were children typically aged between 9 and 14 or 15. We recruited them in slightly different ways, reflecting the different cultures. So in India and Uganda, for example, we needed to go through village elders in order to approach these people. You can see that some of our settings are urban, some are rural. In certain cases, we used benefits or the past receipt of benefits as an indication of their income levels. Income poverty was defined in terms of the normally generally accepted view of poverty in each of these 7 countries. So as you would expect, poverty as understood in Uganda, whatever it is, the 8th poorest country in the world, is radically different from poverty understood in Norway. So effectively it's a relative measure of poverty, even though in Uganda, in India and Pakistan it's defined in absolute terms in terms of the calories required for survival.
Sorry, what was it? SOE?
State-owned enterprises, sorry. China's obviously got urban rural poverty. China's very complicated. One of the forms of poverty which is particularly salient politically is what's called the new poverty, which is that poverty which has been generated by the closing down of the state-owned enterprises, which, if you recall, were in a sense little welfare states in their own right. And so people who were in the sense of the vanguard of the working class are now pushed to the side with very, very minimal social status. And so there's a big element of shame. And that was one of the things that our researcher was particularly interested in looking at. Well, clearly, we're operating in very different worlds. That's trite and obvious. But as somebody who's worked in the north, it's been an illuminating and in many ways a humbling experience to work across these very different countries and to read the transcripts. And I'll come on to reading the transcripts a little bit later on. But essentially profoundly different worlds, as you can see by the built form there. The bottom is a photograph of poverty in the United Kingdom, indication of overcrowding. And the top is a rather of a typical hut, as they're called in Uganda. Different worlds, but very similar aspirations. In an odd sort of way, that's again a bit trite. We're human beings. We expect the same things out of life. So nutrition and food was central in a number of our countries. It was having enough food. It was also having the right food. And that was a very clear distinction you would find in terms of talking to low-income people in the United Kingdom, concerns about obesity, concerns about salt. They bought into the notions of good food. Their problem is they can't afford it. Whereas in Uganda, your problem is cyclical. It's the season. It's according to food that you've actually got, and it's highly dependent on the environment in which you live. But of course, food isn't just about nutrition. Food, as a sociologist as you are, you'll recognise, has enormous symbolic significance. You meet people over food. You respond to an invitation by an invitation back if you can afford to. And if you can't, as in the Ugandan example, in many cases, add salt to the food because you can't afford to buy it, it's unpalatable to somebody that you would invite into your hut if you were prepared to invite somebody back into your hut. And essentially you don't, because you don't want to embarrass and offend. Shelter and housing, likewise, we need it to keep ourselves warm or dry, but equally it's a status, a statement of one's status in society. You know, I was shocked that, what were they shocked? I was shocked at the importance of corrugated iron, that corrugated iron is a device for separating out the very poorest from the less poor in some of the rural communities in which we're working in Uganda. And children telling us that they wouldn't invite their friends back because they had no corrugated iron. The shame associated with living in a particular built form. Human beings, we want control over our lives. We want to be good parents, and we want to be able to be good parents. And that means a control, typically, over resources. And of course, if your resources are tight, you can exert a great deal of management control. And indeed, there's a lot of evidence in Britain that the people who most efficiently purchase food are those with the lowest incomes. But debt is also associated with making ends meet to fill those gaps. And debt is passing control of your life to somebody else. And it's not only in certain contexts deeply humiliating, it's also against religious norms. And so the greater shame associated with it ratchets up. Social expectations were, of course, important in people's lives. The fact that you're poor doesn't mean to say that you're not engaged in your society, or at least aspiring to be engaged in your society. Family, school, health, we aspire to all of those across our samples typically. The extent to which we can fulfill our roles within each of those settings was profoundly compromised by the resources that we had at our disposal. School turned out to be a cockpit of shaming for the kids who were actually in school. The one example exception to that was in Pakistan, where the vast majority of our children weren't in school, and those who were felt very differently about the whole education situation, and the fact that in a way they looked from their school outwards, and they looked, if you like, down on others, whereas in most of the rest of the schools, this looking up and looking down was something of the dynamic of the playground and the classroom and the teacher-child interface and written large in the lives of children and their parents, because the child goes home with the demand that it picks up at school and the parent has to cope. One definition of poverty is the inability to say yes to a child who refuses to take no for an answer. And that dynamic is profoundly important. And of course, sense of self. Most of the people that we spoke to, most of the people on low incomes we spoke to, despised poverty. They despised the state of being poor. And most of them went on to say that they despise themselves for being poor. So if you link that back to sense of self, self is always an apology in the lives of these people. Again, we're talking about qualitative research. We covered approximately the same ground in each of these situations. I'm not wanting to generalise, but I am wanting to tell you the richness and, in a way, the hardwiredness of some of these connections as reported to us by our respondents. And they did, as I've already hinted at, feel that shame was important. In many cases, shame emerged far earlier in the conversations than any reference to difficulties making ends meet. They apologised back to this sense of self before they went on to articulate why it was they were apologising. We certainly, too, have within virtually all of the transcripts a discourse about how I feel about not living up to my expectations of not being a good parent. Profoundly important, the child. You know, how do we evaluate ourselves, bringing up our children, passing on our genes? If we feel totally unable to do so, inadequate, it becomes a major critique of oneself. Equally, they felt that others despised them. And of course, there's a connection there. Their own expectations and the expectations of others are welded within the same communities. You would expect a communality. But they blame themselves. And they feel that shame and generate it. This process of external shaming, I've already mentioned to some extent, the nuclear family is in many ways held together by processes of exchange. If you can't have that reciprocity, you are in a weak position within your family. And indeed, people would argue that you're in a position to be exploited by others in your family. And there are lots of accounts, often around land, which emerged from our discussions in relation to that issue. Again, I'm talking from the perspective of the poor person in poverty, not the other relative. We'll come back to the equivalent of the other relative in a moment. School, I've already, in a sense, briefed you on the importance of school. The workplace is a classic process. We all know, as we wait for an interview for a job on the line, our future on the line, how that feels. If you're doing that on a daily basis, queuing up for casual work, you can see that you're living that experience on a daily basis rather than a once every 5 years or whatever it is. Lots of examples too of exploitation, which is a direct connection between the poor and the non-poor, as again I will mention in a moment. Community, labelling, blaming, ignoring. This notion of being invisible, of being made invisible, of being ignored, of being excluded. Lots of documentary evidence, particularly in the more collectivist societies, and particularly in the village communities, where the village is an important maker of decisions, and the sense that I can't get in. And to be honest, we've just witnessed that. We've been back to Uganda and back to a village meeting where we reported back on our findings, our Ugandan colleagues did. And there were people inside the dwelling and there were people outside the dwelling. Those inside the dwelling had shoes on, those outside didn't have shoes on. I read back from that observation, right or wrong, back to the transcripts, where low-income people said that they felt excluded, they weren't allowed to participate. And what's more, the more wealthy said, we definitely exclude those. Because, and I'll give you some quotations about why the because later. And officialdom, this notion of interacting with policy, my world. The sense of feeling numbered, this notion of presumed guilt. The reason you're here is because you're inadequate. And we have to respond to that inadequacy. Whether that's communicated is an open question. We weren't in a position to observe. The fact that it's understood that that is the case, I can report from the views and conversations that we had. Okay, here we're exploring a potentially crucial area to the whole hypothesis, which is how people respond to shame. Now, we're talking here about the shame that people say is attributable to their lack of resources, okay? So it's not other forms of shame. It's shame that people have a sense identified with their financial or their material state. That shame, the way that it saps, but how do you respond to it? A number of separate discourses, repeated broadly speaking across cultures. Very much this notion of wanting to be normal, wanting to be a Zen, wanting to be human in a sort of way. And then, of course, you have the obvious thing. So if you've got limited resources, you try to get more. If you've got limited resources, you try to maximise their benefits to the family and to the community. Very rational things, and in a sense, you could argue that this is, you might think about this as shame in a positive sense. Here's shame underpinning the capitalist system. Here's shame making people work, making people look after their resources, making people participate in the economy in the sense that they can. And those that are successful are no longer poor. So there's an interesting selection bias in the sorts of people we were talking to. We were talking to people who are currently lacking of income. The description, the worldview of those people without high incomes is that they are trapped. That they are trapped by their limited ability to sell the limited skills that they have, and they see themselves confounded by a set of structural lack of opportunities. Again, you might say, well, they're bound to, aren't they? Because that's about presenting face, keeping face. It's part of the story. That's what they would tell you. It's not what they believe. This process of keeping up appearances, then, to be normal, was a critical part of the discourse. In order to do so, you very often get engaged in pretense. Was it Brassed Off, the movie, where you got this one of the key characters who'd been unemployed for 9 months and had yet to tell his wife? They were pretending, going out every day to work. We've got people in four of our countries who report a very similar sort of experience. In other words, they can't confront the fact that they are no longer breadwinners. They live a life through pretense, but one which is underpinned by the recognition that their lives are pretty insecure, and tomorrow they might be shown up. So they're living in a state of fear. And often, of course, pretense gets out of hand. You overborrow, and the debt collectors close in. Depression. We have three documented accounts of attempted suicide, we have four accounts of suicide in three countries. And the details are harrowing. And the explanation, complicated. So if you commit suicide, it's not a one-to-one cause and effect. But part of the explanation was about the inability to care, in one case, for two kids who were taken to the top of a dam and were pulled back by a passerby. This process, therefore, can be really sapping of self-esteem. Depression, we've already talked about. Drug abuse and alcohol abuse varied across cultures, but were used, often not talked to us in terms of our respondents, but of wives talking about their husbands, and particularly of children talking about their parents. Now, the fact that they're using alcohol doesn't mean to say that that's a consequence of their shame. There's lots of clinical evidence of a direct connection. I can't make it in the sense of our data, but I can report that it was there. This process of withdrawal. Withdrawal in a very pragmatic way. You avoid situations where you have to spend money. You avoid situations where your shame is likely to be exposed. So you don't go to family gatherings. You don't appear at funerals. You certainly don't appear at weddings if you can possibly avoid it. You're physically hiding from bailiffs and moneylenders. Basically, intellectually, socially, morally, question mark, that last one perhaps, a generalised retreat, a disengagement from broader society. And again, this notion of depression, this experience of depression, which was a common recurring theme. Anger, resistance and resignation. If you read the literature, which we read before, there's a lot of anger there. There's a lot of anger and coming together to resist. Amongst our respondents, there was anger, manifested again, the eyes of the children were very important in terms of identifying how that was manifest, in, often in forms of domestic abuse, often fighting over the remaining things that might be in the larder or in the grain tub. But very, very little collective resistance, very little coming together, very little feeling of us against them, that we have the power within our hands to go to the village community and to articulate our case. That sort of anger seemed to be the artistic license of novelists and film. It didn't manifest itself in our conversations with low-income people. What you did get very often is this process of othering, which people like Ruth Lister have written about it in this country and in that, this context. And that's this notion that society is telling me that poor people are essentially feckless and lazy. I'm not like that. But society can't be wrong. So I must be an exception. Other low-income people, they must be the ones who are feckless and lazy. And so you have this splintering rather than a collective resistance that appears in the discourse of the people that we spoke to. So I'm going to move on quickly through the processes of shaming, having shared with you the experience of low-income people who often produce a discourse which is linking poverty, lack of resources, with this sense of shame, and this sense of inadequacy, and this sense of powerlessness associated with that process. Our work with the currently non-poor was done in focus groups, and the recruitment was again reflecting of the processes in which we were operating. South Korea, we haven't done focus groups. You remember I began by saying these groups weren't to talk about shame, they were to talk about, when, in the case, for example, of Britain, we didn't want to poverty in terms of our invitations. We were talking about life in hard times, trying to pick up on the current post-recession sort of discourse about, in a sense, separating out and identifying and stigmatising en route. But we did, when people started to talk about homelessness or hardship and started to introduce the words poverty, we had a conversation about what poverty was like. And as you can imagine, there's a discourse around absolute poverty. Uganda and India, for example, it's self-evident. We live alongside it day by day basis. We step round and it's the other end of the village. We'll come back to that in a moment. In UK and in China and Norway, the discourse was, well, poverty is, that's what exists in South Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. It's not what exists here. We don't really have poverty. In China, there was a recognition that, yes, in the West, in those rural communities, poverty certainly does exist. I remember, indeed, I go home at New Year, and that's real poverty. It doesn't any longer exist in the city. But then you got, of course, a discourse about relative poverty, and it was through a discourse on relative poverty that you got your respondents to begin to engage with the possibility that there were people who had low incomes. Causes. Uganda, India, UK were very individualistic. There's just quotations or citations from Uganda. Laziness, alcohol abuse, polygamy, lack of skills, family background, behavioural traits, educational deficiencies, inheritance of poverty. The focus was on individual failing rather than structural factors, and very loudly so too. Less so in Norway and China. There were individualistic components, but they were often embraced in a structural discourse. And in China, the whole process of economic restructuring was very evident in people's minds and in people's interpretation of the world. The state-owned enterprises, these people weren't themselves from the state-owned enterprises, you will recall, necessarily. There were a range of groups. But that issue of new poverty did emerge. Rural poverty, subsistence, lack of education, lack of connections, the social capital. Think about China and the process of social capital within China loomed large. Health issues were also there. Health issues in terms of reducing people's ability to work. In Norway, labour market was seen as being a problem, increasingly a problem with the process and moves towards flexibility. Discrimination was seen as an explanation for why some people were poor. Often, therefore, that discrimination was manifest in terms of migrants and non-migrants. And the welfare system, that wonderful structure that social policy people always use as an example, the Nordic welfare state, was seen as a cause of poverty and exclusion within a Norwegian system by many of the people who at one side defended it, but another decided it was deeply problematic. The discourse in China and Norway was rather polite. The discourse in the other groups was the opposite of being polite. In Ganda, the poor were arrogant, unprepared to listen to good advice. They were breeding every year like vermin. They were impotent or promiscuous, whichever way. And what's more, you associated with them at your own risk. And by God, you didn't associate with them because you would otherwise risk the contamination that comes from associating with such people. China was polite until you started to talk about professional beggars, until you started to talk about former prisoners, particularly those who were receiving social assistance, and a discussion about able-bodied people too, and back to a discourse that echoes the UK, too lazy to work. But nevertheless, it was a much politer discourse. And it was a discourse which recognised the bigger society and that people all being part of the family that is China. But the adults did report of children being bullied at school, low-income children being bullied at school. And one asks why it was that low-income people were bullied at school if their parents didn't take a similar sort of view. Where did they? Why? Anyway, it's an unanswered question as yet. Deserving and undeserving. In China, Norway, the UK, there was a real clear distinction between deserving, by which we mean those people for whom the state has a responsibility to help and assist, and those who, through their behaviour or through their status or for some other reason, society doesn't need to help and arguably shouldn't, because that would make society more inefficient if they did. In Uganda and India, everybody was equally undeserving. We didn't make those sorts of distinctions. Everybody who was poor was a problem, and everybody who was a problem of their own making. There was an emerging discourse, however, in both India and Uganda, Uganda in particular linked to the discovery of oil, where there was a beginning to pull apart. Those people who were taking up the opportunities of the oil industry were perceived as deserving. Those who weren't were just compounding their own position at the bottom of the income distribution and therefore were to be blamed for not taking up those opportunities. Anybody who has any understanding of the employment opportunities that an oil industry generates in the context of rural subsistence farming may raise the question of the ability of these people to take up these opportunities, such as they are anyway. But that's by and by. The discourse was that people should. Keeping up appearances, almost at the end. Keeping up appearances, I said, was crucially important. Ran into pretense, but it was about status, about who I am as a person, it was about fulfilling my responsibilities. Therefore, I am going to try my damnedest in order to do so, even if it puts me in debt. What do the rich say? UK and Norway, that was just clear evidence of people's wastefulness. Sending their kids with the latest trainers to school? God, we should remove their benefits straight away. It's a total waste of my money. Same is true in UK and Norway. What we get from Uganda and India and China is a confirmation that the poor were shunned and ignored. And also, and this surprised me because of my naive understanding, I suppose, of the culture of collectivist societies, where I saw the family as being crucially important, and it is, was the notion of reciprocity. The affluent argued that the poor within their communities and within their families, who were seeking to live up to those expectations, were just wasteful. The same sort of echo of back to trainer goods. So the gift at the wedding shouldn't be made. What I find quite interesting is that, those people on poor incomes were fearful of the response that would happen if they didn't make those gifts, which is why they did and why they got into debt. Source of understanding, how do people know about low-income people? Well, in Uganda and India, they directly engage with them, their neighbours, albeit a few hundred dollars across the village, particularly their employees. You employ the poor. UK, Norway, China, the media becomes increasingly important. And also a discourse about personal experience. There is a selection bias, I would argue, in all our focus groups, because I think the people who came were people who were at least vaguely interested in issues to do with this, even if we were presented it in terms of a broader framework. So these are, I think, people who are in some sense at least sensitised to the issues. But nevertheless, what I've been reporting is therefore perhaps a sanitised version of how the non-poor think about poor. Personal experience was critical and was one of the reasons that people came. That they had once been poor, or that somebody in a family was now poor through unemployment or whatever. And there was a very interesting discourse. Because those who had been poor had got out of poverty. Why had they got out of poverty? It's obvious, isn't it? They'd worked hard. They'd worked at school. They'd taken the opportunities that were presented to them. And those who were still poor clearly hadn't. And there was this process of reinforcement built into the discourse. So, in summary, if you think about the possibility of shaming and feeling shame, yes, no, a simple mind binary matrix. The literature suggests cases in each of those cells. The literature we looked at prior to going into the field. But the overwhelming story that we get from our seven countries is that people both feel shame and are shamed. Are shamed, they report being shamed. Are shamed, people who are not poor report themselves engaging in process which I can only interpret as being shaming. So, my policy implications, well, society, policy being part of that, surely we should begin to think about policy. And that's in a way what we're doing. We're thinking about policy that might promote dignity. Difficult to quite know what the antonym of shame is, and I'm sure it's not dignity, but it's one which has a degree of currency within the policy world. We have, as a result of this research, influenced a piece of international legislation, which is recommendation 202, which was discussed and voted on at the international session of the ILO this year. And it includes, and it didn't include, a principle of having dignity to promoting the dignity of beneficiaries of a social protection floor. What that means, of course, is an open question. And we are thinking about these issues in terms of the way that we frame policy, the way that we design and structure policy, and the way that we deliver policy, asking questions. Is it shaming? On the other hand, does it promote dignity? And therefore, we've engaged in the policy debate and to an extent brought about a piece of legislative change. On the basis of the diagram that I drew earlier, which of course we haven't demonstrated, what we've demonstrated is that poverty and shame seem to coexist amongst the people that we're talking about, that people's response to shame does appear to be counterproductive, leading in extremis to attempted suicide, certainly, insofar as one can, to depression, certainly social withdrawal, we think. But it's a qualitative account. So the next question seemed to be the extent to which the poverty associated with shame really does constrain agency. I think we have accounts which suggest it, but we need to actually demonstrate that. We need to demonstrate the policies that shame additionally constrain our agency. And the implication and the importance of that is part of the story would be that that policy serves to perpetuate poverty by reducing human agency, and therefore would be profoundly important and true. And the flip side of that, can we change policies in such a way that they promote dignity? The answer is yes, we can if we have the political will. But the really important question is, if we do, does that make them more effective? Thank you.
Question?
I was just wondering from your respondents whether they expressed any particular area of consumption as being particularly shameful that they couldn't afford to keep up with. Whether, for example, if they couldn't afford a certain, their trainers for their kids was more shaming than themselves not being able to afford to go to restaurants.
Yeah. The reason, other than Lindsay's initial work, the reason I got into this in the first place was a discussion I had with now a Chinese colleague, which was just about that. And it came up from me talking about my experience over many years about the importance that parents attach to protecting their children, stopping their children standing out, and arguing that people, adults, lots of evidence, adults will go without in order to protect their children, i.e. prioritising the trainer. Not for the trainer's sake, but what it does to the social engagement of the child. And she argued, that's really interesting, I don't think that would be the case in China, because I think the face that attaches to the family is more important than the face that attaches to the child, who is a less significant part of the family than we are. I don't know the firm answer to that cultural distinction, even having done the research, and that's part of my problem, the management cultural problem, and indeed the problem of doing research in an authoritarian society. But certainly we focused on parents, families with children, partly because we needed in some sense to reduce some of the variance, and their prior in almost all cases was the child. So the education and health of their child were you know, if you can't educate your child, if you can't give your child a tablet when they need it or inoculations because they're desperate, that is profoundly, profoundly important. After that, I think the family is really important. The bigger family, the extended family, this reciprocity, which we've seen rejected by at least our less poor respondents. So the family came next. Everybody wants to work. This notion, at least they tell us that they do, and to be honest, I broadly speaking believe them. In most cases, they're having to work to survive, particularly amongst the very poorest. And there's quite a lot of importance of the nature of that work. So it's not necessarily an expenditure, but it would be great to, sort of some of it is, it would be great to have a decent job. That's particularly the case amongst UK and Sweden. The notion of shit jobs and being confronted with a shit job is part of that view that society doesn't value you because they're insisting that you have a shit job. And that's, you know, I don't want that. Yeah. So there's that sort of tension.
Thank you. That was very interesting. So this reminded me of the interviews that I made a couple of years ago in Turkey with very poor families. And I remember observing similar things, just like you said, like an embarrassment, shame. My topic was about child labor, so maybe people were particularly embarrassed because their children had to work. However, I also remember that I felt that it was my very presence that added to the shame and apologetic attitude there. Me, as a relatively richer and more important, much more educated interviewer, standing right in front of them, more powerful than by all means, made them feel more inadequate and more powerless. And my very presence basically triggered this sense of. This is such kind of feeling. So couldn't it be the case that the very presence of your interviews might somewhat bias the people's...
It certainly is. Clearly we were using locals. We were recruiting people not within the local community, but from outside the local community. And they were common languages, common cultures they were being interviewed with, so it wasn't in a sense me there, or the equivalent of me there. But yes, exactly right. But on the other hand, that's true of all interviewing, and the art of good interviewing is to become a chameleon. The art of interviewing is, insofar as one can, to be a part of the respondent. So it's a dyad. It's not a power relationship. They're clearly power relationships. You're in there. The whole reason you're in there is to exploit them by extracting data from them. But equally, they've said yes. And they have a discourse, they have a set of objectives. Some of their objectives may be about showing you how bad it really is. Equally, they may be a whole set of other objectives. And again, some of the interviews in China and in Korea took over 6 hours. Now, you might say, well, you do say, God, what can you learn in 6 hours, and can they keep going for 6 hours, and all of that sort of stuff. But it's quite difficult to keep up a facade for that period of time. It's quite difficult not to go native to a degree as an interviewer in that time. I think you're right. And in a sense, what we've said all along is this shaming is internally felt and externally imposed. We may, to a degree, be creating it. But we didn't ask directly about it. We asked about their lives. We asked about what it was like. We went humbly to learn. And out of that came that discourse. So I can't guarantee that it's not distorted. How would you distort it? Participant observation? In a way, we were doing that, I guess, with the kids. But it's not clear that you can totally overcome that problem.
I have one comment and one question.
Yeah.
My comment is, are you aware of the paper by Susan Parker that precisely looks at this question in Progresa in Mexico? In Progresa, they go to Appellate to the office, right? So they make a survey about how poor you are.
Yeah.
And then the government goes to check every household. And surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, people lie. They overestimate what they have. So, for instance, they tend to respond that they had a toilet where they don't, a TV, or, you know, this is that making shame to say, no, I don't have this. So I think that's probably you would like to look at it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Thank you.
The question is, it might be a little silly, but it looks like, yes, everywhere there is poverty, there is shame. So, I mean, is it really important, shame, or we should just focus on poverty?
Well, I think we should focus on both. I don't know that there's a distinction. Now, my earlier work has been looking at multidimensionality of poverty, you know, that poverty isn't just income. We experience income loss, but we experience an awful lot of other things which sum up the state that typically we call poverty. So I think they're together. I think multidimensionality takes you in that direction. There are causal stories in terms of which comes first, but again, they're experienced at the point in time by the person who's telling you that. And therefore, I think we need to look at both. We need to look at both, particularly if there's any real meaning in the research that we're doing. If a mechanism through which lack of resources affects people's agency and ability to operate, then it's quite useful to know what that pathway would be. Be even more useful if you could, in a sense, break that pathway or capitalise on that pathway, so you're promoting success rather than not. The issue then becomes, you know, it's an interesting discussion in the World Bank, because the World Bank invited us for 2 days to talk about this research. And there was a fascinating discussion about whether the crucial thing in a world where people are dying from starvation is to get the benefits to people, to get the cash to people, get the work to people, irrespective of how you do it. Or whether you should be sensitive to the way that you do it. Now, I understand that first argument, you know, if you're confronted, and indeed, you know, some of the work is that we did is embarrassing. It's humbling. You're dealing with people who are on that cusp. Indeed, a classic sort of scenario in India was in Gujarat, where Amul, which is a collective that collects milk from, I think it's 250,000 collection points twice daily. It's an enormous enterprise, but at the bottom is somebody coming along with their litre of milk from their one cow. And that litre of milk is the equivalent of $1.25 a day. So as they queue up, waiting for their milk to be assessed, you have the epitome of poor or not poor, and the anxiety on their faces until biologically it's checked and accepted and the cash gets paid, it is very real. Now, therefore, I understand the notion of getting money into the hands of people who otherwise would be starving. But if it doesn't cost any more to do it in a way that recognises that they're human beings rather than cattle, then it seems to me that's something that we should seriously think about. And if our work can be demonstrated beyond where we've reached, that actually doing that makes your delivery, makes your system much more effective, it strikes me we should certainly focus on shame as well as income or resources.
Thank you, this was very stimulating. Let me bring 2 points, I think an easy one and a more challenging one. The first one is...
I don't know that there are any easy ones.
The easy one is, okay, the assumption here is that shame is modified by person situation. And I was wondering whether there would be psychological traits that would be more conducive to shame. Yeah. And if that's the case, then your whole discussion may be...
That's the easy one.
It is the easy one. The most difficult one, I believe, is... Jon Elston sees shame as a fundamental mechanism through which social norms work in our society. So I was wondering whether you can really imagine a world without shame, shameless world, and would any welfare state work in a world where shame is not there for people who are somehow assisted by welfare? Would the unintended consequences of a shameless world be exactly on the other way around? So I'm just playing the devil.
We're struggling with that all the time. You're clearly struggling with that in any discourse you have with policymakers, and the World Bank would be a classic example.
So I'm coming from Italy, and there the issue is, if people cheat on taxes, do they feel ashamed or not? And clearly, if they don't feel ashamed, that's a big problem.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree. In India, you have a below poverty line in India, which is collected every 5 years, I think, and your name goes on that list, and that name on that list gives you access to a range of welfare benefits, not necessarily generous ones, but a range of welfare benefits. And as in a public list looks pretty shaming. In China, for example, the same thing, neighbourhood communities issue social assistance. They put a list of names up in the local neighbourhood and ask the neighbourhood to tick those they think acceptable and those that they think shouldn't get it. Again, issues of shaming, which we would find pretty dreadful. In China, there's a lovely debate, actually, about whether that's shaming or not. And we've got different stories within our groups. India, it's jolly good to get that name on that list. Why? Because a large number of names on that list are people of rich, large landowners. And if you can get your name on that list, it indicates that you've got some degree of influence with the gatekeepers who give you access to that list and give you benefits. And so you've got a distortion the other way around. So it becomes even more complicated when the shaming process has its opposite implications. Clearly, what we know in the sense of all these social emotions is that they have if you take for sake of argument some sort of functionist argument, that they have a role to play. And it clearly is. You know, real debates though about the place of shame. You know, this glorious discussion about Chinese mums or using shame as opposed to many Western parents not using shame, feeling that again saps agency. We don't want to humiliate the child, we want to incentivize the child, which takes you back to incentives as the drivers for welfare. We've actually taken that model and we drive the benefit structure by a belief that incentives are crucial and that this calculation whether you're better off on benefits is profoundly important, which is why we're restructuring the benefit system at the moment. But does that map out on a one-to-one basis with individual behaviour? I rather doubt it, in the same sort of way as I don't think I would nail myself up to say shame is the only thing that matters. I think shame is part of the environment, it's part of the behavioural signals that people live with. And this, I think, is a really interesting bit. If it's right, if all this social psychological work is correct, that shame does sap individual agency. There's lots of experimental stuff, mostly with American students, which is part of the problem. If that's true, then I think we should avoid shame, even if it's only one element. It may be the incentives are far more important. And obviously, as you say, the trade-off between the incentives and shame.
You don't have the evidence on what will happen in the lack of shame scenario.
We don't. Exactly right. But think in your own life. Would you choose, if you had options which are more shaming than others, would you choose those that are shaming? Play it out in terms of survival.
Question to the back.
Can you say that social policies or anti-poverty program should promote dignity instead of shame? In the cases, in the countries that you study, do you have some examples of programs or of policies, some of them promoting shame and others promoting dignity?
They mostly promote shame. Mm-hmm. But some of the in Norway, you've got a really interesting situation which works both ways, because they've introduced a system of human capital investment for people who are on benefits, whereby they take people off benefits, they give them a real salary check, they pay tax. In Norway, paying tax is being part of citizenship. It's seen as a good thing rather than a bad thing, which may be the case in other places. And people like this new system. And in a way, they would choose to go on it. The problem with it becomes the inevitable fact that you have access onto it or not. Some people are allowed onto the programme, others aren't. The decision is discretionary. The officials don't go to a great deal of trouble to explain why you're on and where you're off. So the people who are outside the system see random choice or random decisions over which they therefore have no control because they're random. So you've got this situation that people would choose to go on this programme because it's positive, it's about being in bad engagement. Those who are on it think it's good and think it, they do feel themselves better than the others. You might argue that's opening up another cleavage. But those who are excluded from it, because they don't know why they're excluded, lose their agency. So on the one hand, you have promoting dignity. On the other, you might argue something close to the opposite, because you're denying people the ability to control their own lives.
I thought about the idea of shame and the contrast between deserving and undeserving poor welfare recipient.
Yeah.
The contrast between deserving and undeserving is conditional, right? So if someone is unwell and therefore in poverty, so most people think that they are deserving poor.
I used to.
But the idea of shame, in a way, in a sense, is unconditional, at least in the way that Sam talked about it. He was quoting Adam Smith, if you don't have a linen
shirt,
you don't feel you want to go out, right? So I wonder how that sort of unconditionality, you just can't make certain standard of living and you withdraw yourself from, being a fully participating member of the community. That's a key thing, right?
Yeah.
So that's one point. The other thing is to say that we really need to know, sort of, in the seventh society you talk about. So, what kind of behavioural consequence of being shamed, of being in poverty is? Are these people really sort of not interacting with the rest of the community, not sending their kids to school, or what?
All of those things.
I doubt it, though. I mean, kind of, sort of. People may be, to what degree do you need to, how poor do you need to be before you really withdraw your kid from sending him to school or her to school, right?
Well,
and that is, it's not clear to me. And also it depends, this go back to the conditional and unconditional point too, you know. To use your word discourse, there are other discourses, right? You know, I'm poor but I'm proud. You know, proud being, you know, to be a hardworking person.
And indeed they are and aspire to be, and that's part of the make-believe. And the literature promotes the notion of the positive poor, and indeed in China you get it institutionalised. You're poor in the Maoist era. You were poor for the benefits of others. You were going to, each poor person was a brick that was going to be built at that society, and the poor were praised inordinately. The stories that we get are that that people feel embarrassed, lots of words for shame. And that the accounts that we've got echo very much the social psychological accounts of how people would be expected to respond according to shame. We are reliant on shame being described as being due to this lack of resources by the respondent. We don't know, it could be shame for other reasons. But the story is quite harsh and most of the people, probably all of the people, manifested behaviours which are likely to be unproductive for them as a consequence of this story. Going back to the deserving, undeserving, it's fascinating. You're right that certainly the way we administer benefits, that's a profound distinction. It's our money, we only want it to go to people who deserve it. And one wouldn't question that at many, well, we don't question that at many levels. But one of the interesting things I've been trying to understand this over time, and reading historians of the 15th, 16th, 17th century, that period of time before the poor law came in. So 1552 is when the state starts to get involved in poor law administration. The historians, and here I'd love some support or love somebody to question me, are arguing that when the church delivered welfare, it made no judgments. It made no judgments among the deserving and undeserving. In other words, it was unconditional in the way that you're describing. If somebody was poor, the state would help them with alms. Interesting to know how that pays out in Muslim cultures too at the moment. Because what you've had in Pakistan is a nationalisation of that religious form of support. But when the state got involved in 1552, the local parishes did begin to make this distinction of who was deserving and undeserving. And there's some sort of story that you could build that because Britain built its welfare state earlier, or the church lost its influence earlier than across much of Western Europe, you found the state involved earlier, making distinctions about undeserving and deserving, which was partly helps to explain why our focus is on poverty relief rather than social cohesion and social solidarity. And ultimately, therefore, for example, why the UK finds it difficult to live in Europe, where there's a much greater emphasis on collective responses to these without quite the same distinctions between deserving and undeserving. I don't know. I find that a fascinating possibility. But the bottom line is we're dealing with 200 people who give consistent accounts that their lives have been afflicted by poverty and the consequences of feeling unperson-like as a result of that, and that shapes the way they think about the future and shapes what they think they can do in relation to other people.